Accession number 19043, Reel 3.
Colonel Pemberton, Reel 3. So, you're in hospital where?
I was in hospital at Caserta, in an old castle or fort. And I was there for about 10 days.
What did you think of the treatment you got there?
Well, I thought it was very good. I was, as I say, I was not seriously incapacitated. And there were many people far worse than I was. But I thought the hospital treatment was very good. I really wanted to get out. I could walk, and I thought it was ridiculous being kept in there. And I'm afraid I behaved rather badly. I broke out once, and they got rather tired of me. And I think that they were glad to put me on a hospital ship to come back to England.
You broke out with what intention?
With the intention of going down to Naples and enjoying myself. And there was another chap with me. We had a great night out one night. But, my arm was no good, but I was perfectly fit otherwise.
Did you make a full recovery from the wound?
No, when I got home, I was sent to the Wingfield Morris Hospital, which specialised in these nerve wounds. And they carried out various tests and found that the nerve had not been completely cut. And and over a period of time, with treatment and exercising and so on, I virtually got back the complete use of my hand again.
Where is this Wingfield Morris Hospital?
Just outside Oxford. I think it's still there. But I had a period of convalescence, as it were, when I could be at home, but I had to go for treatment, physiotherapy treatment. But I was at home for a month or two, at any rate, a month or two. And it wasn't until, I spent a little time at Pirbright on the training staff then, a month or two doing that. And then in September, I was posted to join the 5th Battalion in the Guards Armoured Division. Which at that time, the Guards Armoured Division was stationed or was involved in the fighting around Nijmegen, and the Arnhem operation had just come to an end when I joined the battalion. So we had a pause then, and spent Christmas in a Dutch village just near Nijmegen. I was a platoon commander in number 1 company.
Do you remember which platoon?
Number 8 platoon. And the company commander was a very experienced officer called Major David Canard, who had been with the 3rd Battalion from Alamein right through the North African campaign and then switched to the 5th Battalion. He was a very experienced man, a very gallant man. It was quite an experience to come from an infantry battalion, in an infantry brigade, to a lorried infantry battalion, which is the 5th Battalion, was in an armoured situation. And the Guards Armoured Division, as you probably know, formed a unique organisation in that we had a Coldstream group. There was a regiment or a battalion of Coldstreamers with tanks, an armoured battalion, and a lorried infantry battalion, also Coldstreams. So we had a Coldstream group, and there was a Grenadier group and an Irish Guards group, and so on. And I think that was a wonderful organisation, because we'd all had the same sort of upbringing and the same ideas about soldiering, the same views on life, and I think it was very much more difficult sometimes when an infantry battalion and an armoured battalion were thrown together for an operation and they'd never seen one another before and so on. So I do think we had an absolutely first-class organisation, which I think proved its worth. When we moved from Nijmegen, we only went a short distance to begin with, and we held a position at a place called Sittard, where we just held the line there, as it were, and Germans patrolled up to us at night. We did a bit of patrolling at night, but nothing very serious happened. And we moved, trying to think where we went then. We moved around in Belgium, various places, really holding the line. I think it was while the army was building up after this great surge up to Nijmegen and Arnhem, towards Arnhem. There was a pause while the lines of communication were strengthened and the operations went on around Antwerp and places like that. And we had a comparatively quiet time. We had held various positions, but it was generally just holding a position and patrolling a bit, but there was no very decisive action. We lost a few people on patrols. The Germans were very effective in their use of mines, and what was it? There was a mine that used to jump up. It was connected. It had tripwires. I can't remember what it was called, but it had tripwires. When you set off the tripwire, it sprung up in the air and exploded. And it was a pretty lethal thing, and we lost one or two people in those situations on patrol. But nothing very exciting happened until Christmas 1944, when we were rushed down on Christmas Eve, I think it was. We suddenly were told that we'd got to move post haste to get down to Namur, which was one of the bridges over the Rhine, which led to the Ardennes, and the German Ardennes offensive was by then underway. And I remember my platoon had to man a bridge in Namur. Our headquarters was in the Rouge et Noir pub. I can remember it on one side of the bridge. And we had some of the armoured battalion with us as well. And we had to check everyone coming over the bridge. And I remember being particularly warned to check on all nuns, because some of the Germans had dressed up in nuns' habits. And they were two rather amusing experiences.
Can you tell me about them, please?
Well, you can imagine asking a nun to whether she's carrying a rifle or if she's got any weapons on her. It's not very easy. I mean, we didn't, and one could tell fairly quickly whether it was a female or a German soldier, but we did have to check. And we sat down on the bridge for a day or two, wondering what on earth was going to happen. Fortunately, as you know, the Ardennes offensive was held in the end, but it was quite touch and go, I think, for a while. Then the next battle we got involved in was the Reichswald Forest, where it was really clearing the west bank of the Rhine from Nijmegen down towards the southeast. And we had to take part in the sort of latter stages of that. It was a pretty ghastly battle, I think, for those who were involved in the forest. Reichswald Forest, a thick forest, and there was a lot of very heavy, unpleasant fighting there. But by the time we got back up there, the Germans had been pushed out of the forest and were in more open country, which was more suitable for our tanks to operate in.
What was so unpleasant about the Reichswald?
Well, it was very cold, snow. It got very muddy, vehicles sticking in the mud, and the conditions were very, very tough and unpleasant. And then from then on, we were pushing the Germans back towards the Rhine. And we had one rather memorable battle in which we had to attack from the Bonninghardt Heights towards Wesel. And it was across flat farmland with isolated farms and not much cover, but at any rate, we did achieve our objectives, and then we had to endure a most terrific bombardment, which turned out to be the Germans' last effort to keep us back while they evacuated and crossed the Rhine. And I personally was in a cellar in a farmhouse when this was going on, so I didn't experience much of it, except that there were bombs going off or shells going off all round. But it was their last ditch effort, and when that stopped, it became clear that they had actually gone back over the Rhine. And so that was the end of that action as far as we were concerned. We then went back some miles and waited, and we didn't cross the Rhine ourselves until a bridgehead had been gained on the other side. And then we went over, and we had an exciting drive up through Holland with very determined resistance, which one couldn't help but admire, from the 7th German Parachute Division. And they were quite tough opponents, I must say. But and they kept going to the last. In fact, we accepted their surrender in the end, when we got to Cuxhaven, and they were still a disciplined force. There were various moments on the way up which sort of live in my memory. One was the crossing of the canal at Lingen, when the company commander of number 3 company won the VC, and his name was Little. He won the VC by going across the bridge on his own with a pair of wire cutters, and he cut the wires connected to the bombs under the bridge, which enabled the rest of the company to get over, and he was awarded a VC. Ian Little was his name. Sadly, he was killed in a small skirmish about 4 days later, which was very sad.
Did you know Ian Little yourself?
I knew him very well. He was second in command of the company when I joined it, and then he was promoted to take over command of number 3 company, and I was promoted to be second in command of number 1, so I replaced him as second in command of number 1 company. I knew him very well. Yes.
What kind of a man was he?
Very self-effacing, very amusing man. Enjoyed life, great raconteur, played the piano brilliantly. Great fun person to have around. Was a modest sort of man. I mean, not an obvious person who you'd expect to win a VC. and I wasn't. I didn't see the action because we weren't in sight of the bridge, but we knew it was going on, and it was all planned and carried out fairly spontaneously, without much delay. He just said, I'm going to do this, I want as much fire support as possible, and got some tanks up and got the company in positions to fire, and he just went. He had to climb over a barricade, get onto the bridge. It's almost unbelievable, with Germans sitting just on the other side. But they were keeping their heads down because all hell was being sort of directed at them from the tanks and other people. But even so, it's almost unbelievable. It was, I think, as good a VC as you could get, almost. But there were some nasty little skirmishes all the way up, and as I say, the Germans kept at it, and it amazed me that they were still a fighting force. And when they eventually got to Cuxhaven, they formed up on the aerodrome there, such as were left of them, and they were tough. They were still disciplined, and their soldiers at that stage, the war was over, the armistice had been signed, and their troops were smart. They saluted us as officers and so on, very impressive. On the way up, of course, we had seen some pathetic examples of the sort of people they'd had to recruit in various arms, sort of old men and young boys and so on. But the hard core of 7th Para Division was very professional, right up to the end. You have to admire them. Very tough. There was one group once who were captured. I couldn't name the place. It wouldn't mean anything. Somewhere near Enschede, I think. And our squadron of tanks took them prisoner, about half a dozen of them. And we knew that there were Germans all sort of all around and so on, and they were told to keep quiet. And they started making a noise. I think they literally thought they would attract attention. And the squadron commander was all set, our squadron commander was all set to shoot them. We had to convince them that he meant what he said, and they'd got to shut up, and they did. But they, you know, even when captured, they were tough characters. I don't think I've got much more to say about the war in Europe. At the end of the hostilities, we went back to Cologne, and very quickly, the Guards Armored Division was disbanded. And when I say quickly, I mean within a week or two, or a few weeks. We had a great parade, and that was farewell to armor. And then volunteers were called for to go as a battalion to, the idea was to go to the United States to be equipped there and to go to Japan, I suppose, as a token force showing solidarity or something. So a lot of us volunteered for that. And but before we could go, the atom bombs were dropped, and so that idea came to an end. And so the group were then formed into a battalion, which was the 3rd Battalion Coldstream, and we formed up at Hawick in Scotland, and the next thing we knew, we were on our way to Palestine to enforce the mandate there. It was a United Nations mandate in those days. And after a little training at Hawick, that's where we went. I was by then, I was deputed to be a training officer in this battalion. But the second in command of the battalion, who should have gone on the advance party, decided to get married. And so I was told to be the advance party commander for our battalion. And together with a grenadier and a Welsh Guards representative, we went off with the brigade major, who was Willie Whitelaw in those days, and the staff captain. The five of us went off as the advance party. I can remember flying in a York aircraft from Bournemouth to Cairo. And we stayed a night at the Shepherd's Hotel and then caught the train up to Haifa. And we were the advance party, had to plan the camp for our brigade. And that was quite an interesting time. We didn't really know what we were in for. It was a lovely country to arrive at. Have you ever been to Bosnia? No. Well, it was lovely, and of course, not very heavily populated in those days. But the troubles were to come with the enormous influx of Jewish refugees from Eastern Europe. And as we were responsible for the mandate, we had to try and control this, because if we hadn't tried to control them, they would have just pitched their tents everywhere, as it were. They would have settled on land, they'd have had squabbles with the Arabs and so on. The whole thing had to be controlled in some ways. And of course, we became very unpopular with the Jews and the Arabs too. We were in between. But generally speaking, the Arabs were, well, they were easier to get on with than the Jews.
What were the problems in getting on with the Jews?
Well, that they set up their terrorist groups, the Stern Gang and the Ergens bei Leumi, to try and drive out the British. So they were positively attacking us, and they kidnapped various soldiers from time to time and strung them up in orange groves, and they would put taut wires across the road to try and behead people driving in open jeeps and things like that. One had to be a bit careful. But the Arabs rather endeared themselves to us in the ways that there was a certain honesty and code of honour that the Arabs preserved. I don't know whether it still goes on, but I remember you could go to an Arab village looking perhaps for arms or something like that, and you'd go to the Mukhtar's house, the headman's house, and without any question you could leave your weapons, anything, in the jeep outside the house while you went in. Nothing would be touched if you were a guest of the Mukhtar. But they'd come and pinch stuff from your camp at night if they could. But that was the sort of touch that rather appealed to me. I thought it was rather nice. I don't suppose that goes on anymore, but it could do. But it was such a lovely country, and we had a certain amount of time off, and travelling around Israel was interesting. One could get up to Damascus and places like that and do a bit of exploring while one was there. And of course there was some very good duck shooting on Lake Huli in the north of the country.
Were you a platoon commander in Palestine?
No, I was the training officer to begin with. Most of my time, no, I was training officer to begin with, and then I was second in command of number one company. And
but evidently you went out on raids to the villages, did you?
Not exactly raids. Well, we did searches of Jewish settlements, searching for arms. And then we had the unique experience. The Coldstream Battalion had to impose martial law on Tel Aviv. It never been done before, I don't think, or since, which meant that we took over the courts and we ran the city. We dictated to the city council what should be done and so on and all this sort of thing. It was a tremendous commitment. Of course, while we were doing that, we made a lot of enemies with the Jews, and they tried to blow up our headquarters, which was in the Shell building in Tel Aviv. But it was an impossible thing to administer, and it didn't last very long. But for about a month, we ran Tel Aviv. And the courts, as I say, the second in command,